Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
The people and projects trying to make our world a better place.
I just saw the problem and I knew that there is a way we can use technology to solve it.
People fixing the world from the BBC World Service.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and at 13 hours GMT on Monday the 8th of April, these are our main stories. The military in Myanmar has begun calling up Rohingya Muslims to fight for the army, despite subjecting them to years of persecution. More than 10,000 homes are underwater in Russia as flooding from the Ural Mountains spreads. And Boeing faces more problems as a part from one of its planes falls off mid-flight. Also in this podcast, eBay says it'll drop fees for people selling old clothes to stop them going to landfill. And
for me, really, the villains of the film, it's addiction and paparazzi.
The movie which asks what drove the singer Amy Winehouse to an early death. It's 7 years since the Rohingya people of western Myanmar suffered unspeakable massacres. The exact death toll isn't known, but it's been estimated that the Myanmar army probably murdered more than 25,000 people, prompting more than a million others to flee the country into neighbouring Bangladesh. The Rohingya had long suffered discrimination and were never given citizenship of Myanmar, although most had lived there for generations. But despite not being citizens, the BBC has found that hundreds of Rohingya have now been conscripted to fight for Myanmar's army. The investigation was carried out by our Southeast Asia correspondent, Jonathan Head.
It looks like this is a systematic attempt to fill the ranks that have been depleted across Myanmar as the army has been driven back and suffered defeat after defeat. Lots of surrenders, lots of soldiers killed. They're really struggling. They've been forced conscription across the country. Nobody ever thought that they would bring in the Rohingyas. The Rohingyas are viewed with contempt, openly racist contempt, by most of the military elite. They view them as not belonging in Myanmar. The ones who live still in Rakhine State, who weren't driven out in that ghastly kind of ethnic cleansing that you referred to, many of them are confined to these really squalid camps, about 150,000 of them. And they're telling us that teams of military have been going around since mid-February and telling them they have to join up. They have to go for training. And after 2 weeks of training, where they're taught how to use a rifle, they've been thrown into some pretty fierce battles. Now, you have to understand that in Rakhine State, where there was this ethnic cleansing, there is now a full-scale civil war involving the other ethnic group there, the Rakhine Buddhists, who are backing an insurgent group called the Arakan Army, and they've been having tremendous successes. They've taken control of much of the state. The army is on the run. They've lost control of most of the northern part and central parts of Rakhine, and they're desperate to hold on. And they're now forcing these Rohingyas, who they once tried to wipe out and drive out of the country, to fight for them. It's very, very grim. The Rohingyas feel absolutely desperate. They're not being given a choice. Their families are being threatened. Those who've been in combat say the experience was so grueling and awful. I mean, one man was in an 11-day battle to hold on to three military posts in a town called Ratidong before they were driven out. He's been injured in both legs and he's hiding now, trying to avoid being sent back to the front line. The Rangers just feel that they're caught in the middle of this fight and that they're unwitting partners in it.
Given how they're seen by most people in the military, as you said, the fear presumably is that they're just going to be used as cannon fodder, aren't they? I mean, their military's not going to care if they live or die.
No, and that's a fear that actually everyone in Myanmar has about conscription. The military in Myanmar has been fighting wars against ethnic insurgents for decades, and they do it old style, and I've seen it myself. It is like trench warfare. They just throw waves of men in. They always lose huge numbers. It's why young men are fleeing the country to avoid this conscription law. But these Rohingyas have no choice. They've been confined to these camps for 12 years. They're not allowed to move without permission, so they're completely trapped. They are being used as cannon fodder, but there's a more problematic consequence of this, and I think the military is well aware of this. Traditionally, there are very difficult relations between the Rohingya Muslims and the Rakhine Buddhists, who are, of course, backing this insurgency. That was also part of the fuel behind the ethnic cleansing in 2017. That tension has died down, and this Rakhine Buddhist insurgent army is talking about a more conciliatory approach and perhaps thinking about bringing Rohingyas back from Bangladesh. But now the Rohingyas are fighting on the army side, albeit very unwillingly. That is creating ethnic tension. It's likely to cause serious problems between these two communities. And the Arakan army looks like it's going to take control of Rakhine State, and it's going to take a very dim view of Rohingyas, who it's found itself fighting against in these battles.
Our correspondent Jonathan Head with Paul Moss. Russia's emergency ministry says flooding from the Ural Mountains is spreading. 39 regions across Siberia, the Volga region and central parts of Russia are becoming inundated, leaving more than 10,000 homes underwater. And it's not just Russia being affected. On the other side of the mountains, 75,000 people have been evacuated from their homes in northern Kazakhstan. Our Europe regional editor Nikki Cardwell has been following developments.
Basically, anywhere that is downstream of the Ural River is getting runoff. So that's 18,000 kilometres from the Ural Mountains down to the Caspian Sea. This is a climate issue. It's been several months of unseasonable weather. In the autumn, they had torrential rains, which promptly froze. They had temperatures of minus 10. So instead of that water running off, it froze in the soil. And then it snowed on top of it, because that's what happens in the winter. And they've just had a heat wave. So all of that snow and ice has thawed over a very short space of time, and it's all heading downriver.
Vladimir Putin is a climate change sceptic. So what, if anything, is the Russian government saying?
He was a climate sceptic, but he's changed his tune recently and he's starting to embrace a lot of these issues. In fact, he's told Russia he wants them to prepare for these climate issues that occur and weather phenomena that we're seeing all over the world. So he's sent his emergencies minister to fly to the area to coordinate coverage. They've also been releasing footage of what's going on there, which is very unusual from the Kremlin. So they do seem to be trying to get a grip on this.
And in terms of Kazakhstan, it sounds, if anything, like the situation's even worse.
It is. It's covering a much wider area. Earlier on, the BBC spoke to the Deputy Foreign Minister of Kazakhstan, Roman Vasilenko. He says they're doing everything they can to help those affected.
We had floods in 2012, 2017, but this is the most serious flood in 80 years. More than 75,000 people, including 17,000 children, have so far been evacuated. But 65 villages and settlements remain still cut off.
So, Nikki, this is a huge number of people affected by these floods. What are the wider implications of what's happening?
There are issues beyond what's happening to people on the ground. Kazakhstan is one of the world's biggest producers of uranium. And over the weekend, we saw the markets reacting to concerns that they may not be able to carry on producing this amount. We saw alternative suppliers, the value of their stocks going up. But the implications for fuel prices, for places like France, where they rely on nuclear energy, if they can't get their uranium fuel tablets, then there will be implications for people much further in the region.
Nikki Cardwell reporting. It's now 2 years since invading Russian troops were forced out of the Ukrainian town of Bucha near Kyiv. You might remember the reporting at the time about dozens of civilian bodies strewn across the street. Our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford has been back to Bucha to find some of the people she met 2 years ago.
When Russian soldiers killed Ludmila's husband, she had to wrap him in a blanket and bury him in their garden. This was Valery's second burial at the town cemetery. It was 2022, after Ukrainian forces had liberated Bucha from a month under occupation. What they discovered there shocked the world. I've always remembered the story Ludmila told me then, by the side of Valery's grave. How Russian troops had driven a tank into the pensioner's yard and taken over their house. The couple hid in their cellar, but when Valery emerged, he was shot in the back of the head. Two years later, I found Ludmila at her home, but it's now a construction site. The couple's house was destroyed in the battle for Bucha, and it's slowly being rebuilt as part of a giant restoration project for the town. Ludmila is anxious for it to be ready, but when it is, she'll live there alone. When I ask how she's coping, she says she has high blood pressure now and heart problems. She blames the stress and the memories. The one thing that calms her, though, are the flowers. She points out the crocuses and the bluebells in her garden, the flowers that survived everything to bloom again in beautiful flashes of colour. Ludmila tells me the investigation into Valeria's death is still open, one of hundreds of war crimes cases in Bucha. So I asked how important it was to her to find her husband's killers.
Russia will never hand them over. It's very unlikely someone will be punished for this in my lifetime. But it's important. Of course it is. It would be even better for me to be able to grab that scumbag by the throat myself.
Across town, there are children out playing in the yard of a block of flats. Most people who lived in Bucha before the war have returned now, and life on this sunny day looks peaceful again. But Natalia's suffering isn't over. When we first met, she told me how her husband Bogdan had been detained by Russian soldiers and disappeared. Now she tells me she's found him being held prisoner in Russia, even though he's a civilian. Ukrainian soldiers who were held in the same place but have been exchanged have described conditions there.
It was really tough. They didn't feed them and they beat them badly. They were tortured with electric shock, with batons, with pipes.
Natalia is actually ethnically Russian herself, born here but with parents from the country that invaded Ukraine and is now detaining her husband illegally and abusing him. And although things seem calm in Bucha right now, Natalia's worried.
You see what's happening, what Putin is up to, saying Ukraine is to blame for the Moscow terrorist attack. Then they send ballistic missiles here. I think he wants to declare full-out war.
Sarah Rainsford reporting from Bucha. The airline called it a mechanical issue, rather mild language to describe how a piece of one of its planes fell off at the start of the flight. And not just any piece, but part of the casing which surrounds the engine. What's more, it was a Boeing 787-800 travelling from Denver in the United States. And as Will Vernon now explains, it's just the latest alarming incident involving a Boeing aircraft.
In a statement, the US Federal Aviation Authority said the aircraft's crew reported that a piece of the engine cowling, or casing, had fallen off during takeoff and struck the wing flap. Video posted on social media shows mangled sheets of metal around one of the engines flapping in the wind before breaking off. In a statement sent to the BBC, Southwest Airlines said the flight landed safely after experiencing a mechanical issue, which was being reviewed by maintenance teams. This is the latest in a series of bizarre incidents involving parts falling off Boeing aircraft in the United States. In March, a fuselage panel was found to be missing from a Boeing after arrival at an airport in Oregon. Earlier that month, a tire fell off a Boeing 777 during takeoff from San Francisco. And in January, an Alaskan Airlines 737 MAX 9 suffered a mid-air emergency after an unused cabin door blew out during the flight. Although it is the airlines that are responsible for maintenance and inspection of their fleets, Boeing is nevertheless coming under increasing pressure over the safety of its aircraft.
Here in the UK, the online marketplace eBay has announced big changes to its selling fees to try to help the environment. The details from Suranjana Tiwari.
This is an effort to keep pre-loved clothes out of landfill, so it's really doing something for the environment. Now, the online marketplace has dropped fees for individuals to sell pre-owned clothing, and that means it's free to sell all second-hand clothing, including brand new items with tags on that have never been worn. But seller fees will still apply to trainers, watches, handbags and jewellery. And listings that are already up will also benefit from this free selling. The reason this is happening is, of course, to improve the sustainability of fashion and to prevent some of the negative impacts of things like fast fashion. There's a company called Vinted, which has become extremely popular in the UK. And this is probably why eBay is doing this, because Vinted allows you to sell your secondhand, not just clothes, but goods. And people have really jumped on the bandwagon. So eBay probably wants a slice of that pie, since it was the original marketplace where you could sell secondhand goods.
Suranjana Tiwari reporting. And still to come. celebrations in London and Paris to mark the 120th anniversary of the Entente Cordiale.
The Global Jigsaw is the podcast looking at the world through the lens of its media.
State media know which topics they can and can't discuss.
We fill gaps and connect dots to better understand what's happening in the world.
It's important to remember the context.
And untangle the narratives aimed at influencing your views.
Tightly controlled.
It's not so healthy to be a journalist there.
The Global Jigsaw from the BBC World Service. Listen now by searching for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is coming under pressure from within his own government not to abandon plans for an assault on Rafah in southern Gaza. Israel's right-wing National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir has warned Mr. Netanyahu that he'll withdraw support for his governing coalition unless the offensive goes ahead. This comes as both Israel and Hamas have played down reports of progress at talks aimed at finding a truce in Gaza. Michelle Hussein asked our international editor Jeremy Bowen for his assessment.
There are these ceasefire talks and prisoner exchange talks going on in Cairo, presided over by the head of the CIA, the head of Egyptian intelligence, and the Qatari prime minister. The Americans, I think, are trying to push very hard for a deal. There are various leaks and rumours coming out. But, you know, it may be, and this theory is knocking around in the Israeli media this morning, that pulling back from southern Gaza may be a way, if you like, a sop towards, or a little step towards, the Hamas position of them pulling out of Gaza completely and therefore trying to help those negotiations.
And these talks in Cairo, which you mentioned, there have been versions of this which have happened before. What can you tell us about how they work? Do Israelis and Hamas end up in the same room together? And do you think there is any kind of different move to get towards the deal today than there has been in recent weeks?
They absolutely do not go in the same room, and the Americans don't go in the same room either as them. So there are representatives there of the political leadership of Hamas, and the Qataris basically talk to them and the Egyptians, and then they relay that back to the Americans, and they relay things to the Israelis. So it's quite a cumbersome process, and then the Hamas people then have to go away and get a message, I don't know how they do it, to Yahya Sinwar, who's their leader, presumably in a tunnel somewhere under Gaza with a human shield of Israeli hostages around him, as well as his own bodyguards. And so it's a slow, slow process. And there have been loads of leaks and rumours over the months when they have these meetings about whether it's going well or whether it's going badly. So I would treat all of them with massive caution, because I think it's a huge task for those people involved in it, for the head of the CIA, William Burns particularly, to try and bring two sides together to make a deal who really are a long way apart. There is a deal that can be made if Israel is prepared to pay the price in terms of releasing Palestinian prisoners to swap for hostages, and if Hamas is prepared not to insist on Israel leaving Gaza in its entirety.
Our international editor, Jeremy Bowen. Rescue workers in Mozambique are searching for survivors from a boat that sank off the northern coast with dozens of people on board. Some passengers have been found alive, but almost 100 are known to have drowned. The authorities in Nampula province say most were trying to reach an island following a panic caused by disinformation about a cholera outbreak. More from our Africa correspondent, Jenny Hill.
Officials say that 130 or so people were crammed onto what they've described as a converted fishing boat, which they say was overcrowded and unsuitable for the transport of passengers. It's not yet clear what led the boat to sink, nor do we know why there were so many people on board. One local politician has said that at least some of those passengers are believed to have been fleeing the mainland for this island because they were concerned about cholera. Now, there's been a big outbreak of the disease in a number of southern African countries in recent months. This particular part of Mozambique, the Nampula province, has been one of the worst affected, with something like 15,000 cases, 30 deaths. So that is one line of inquiry, if you like, although at the moment the focus is very much on search and rescue. As you'd expect, people in the area have been reacting with shock, not least because of the high number of victims and so many children said to be among the dead. I think, though, that this will perhaps increase some pressure on the authorities. Local journalists have told the BBC that there have been concerns in recent times about boat safety, ferry operators and the authorities coming under calls to try and improve standards. No doubt this particular tragedy will simply serve to strengthen those demands.
Now, the report's findings are stark. Independent experts in Portugal have found that about 5,000 children were sexually abused there by priests since the 1950s. Today, Catholic bishops are beginning a four-day meeting to decide whether to pay compensation to the victims. From Lisbon, here's Alison Roberts.
The hierarchy's response to the devastating report on abuse by priests and others within the Portuguese church has been found wanting by many observers, including leading Catholics. Portugal's top bishop at the time, now retired, said that offering financial compensation to victims would be insulting. His successor says it should be considered, along with psychological and other support. According to local media reports, the leadership remains split on the issue, but a group of experts set up by the church in the wake of the report to receive complaints of abuse has reportedly already received a number of requests for compensation. It has already passed on details of 50 suspected abuse cases to the church and 18 to prosecutors and police.
For the first time in 120 years, British and French soldiers have swapped roles to mark the anniversary of the signing of the Entente Cordiale, the Treaty of Friendship between Paris and London. French soldiers took part in the changing of the guard at Buckingham Palace and met the brother of King Charles, the Duke of Edinburgh. British soldiers supported their counterparts at the Élysée Palace in Paris. I heard more from our correspondent in the French capital, Hugh Schofield.
We've just seen President Macron out on the street. He's gone back in with the British ambassador, having witnessed this brief but still quite impressive ceremony, very colourful, in which 16 members of the Coldstream Guard, that's part of the household division that guards the royals in Britain, came over and joined the Republican Guard, the French Guard, in a kind of parade with the national anthems on the street outside the Élysée Palace, and then they processed into the courtyard of the Élysée Palace, and the British soldiers have taken part in a changing of the guard ceremony there. The similar thing is happening in London. A highly and totally symbolic gesture on this 120th anniversary. Now, you might think the 120th anniversary is an odd one to celebrate of the Entente Cordiale, but I think that's the point in a way. They did nothing at the 110th, but the 120th, they're trying to make the point that despite Brexit, despite the vagaries of diplomacy between the two countries, the alliance is still very much alive. And it's occasions like this anniversary now, that they're using to drive this point home.
This is a bit of a university essay question, Hugh, but what is the Entente Cordiale?
The Entente Cordiale was signed in 1984 between Britain and France, and it brought to an end a number of disputes linked to the colonial era between the two countries. That was one side of it. More importantly and more historically relevantly, what it did was usher in the last century and more of cooperation. So at the time, no one realised what was going to happen subsequently. In practice, what happened was that the two countries got closer and closer together, fought side by side in two world wars, and have had a very, very close alliance ever since, an alliance which is now represented most clearly in the military cooperation which still goes on between the two armed forces.
But put to the test a little bit in recent years by Britain's decision to leave the European Union.
Indeed, which is why I think this 120th anniversary celebration is interesting. It's kind of reinforcing the point, maybe stretch it a little, to create an event here today, because both governments, particularly against the background of Ukraine, want to say, look, on a number of levels, things are going smoothly between the two countries, particularly on the military and defence side. And at this moment in history, it's very, very important that cooperation be sustained and developed.
Hugh Schofield with me from Paris. What was it that drove the singer Amy Winehouse into the alcoholism and self-destruction which eventually killed her? Was it just living life in the headlights of fame at a young age? Were the paparazzi to blame, ruthlessly exposing every step of her decline? And how should we remember a woman regarded as a vocal maestro, but perhaps not the best role model for other young people? These questions and others are addressed by a new film about Winehouse. Its star, Marisa Abela, and director Sam Taylor-Johnson spoke to our culture correspondent, Charlotte Gallagher.
but I say it, no, no, no.
Amy Winehouse, a music legend. Now a new film, Back to Black, is telling her story. Marisa Abela plays Amy.
I want people to hear my voice.
I was so excited by the idea of playing and getting in touch with Amy, the girl, and then Amy, the singer, and the woman before the icon.
Director Sam Taylor-Johnson told me why she cast Marisa.
It was important mostly that I could find someone that wasn't going to impersonate Amy. There were many brilliant impersonators and people that looked like her or sounded like her, but Marisa came in as herself, was the only one in the audition process who didn't try to look like her in any way, earrings, eyeliner or anything.
From primary school,
no, no, no,
to sell out concerts.
Amy's mum and dad are depicted in the film, but the family weren't involved in making it.
I went to the family, you know, really out of respect that I was making a film about their daughter, and I just wanted to sort of sit with them and hear their stories and then go off and make the film that I wanted to make. So they didn't have involvement, as in they could say what I could and couldn't do.
They came to set. I think it was incredibly important for me, again, to be respectful, especially when I'm in character. It was important to just be aware of the sensitivity of that moment.
Me.
I want to be a wife. I want to be a mum.
A big part of Back to Black is Amy's troubled relationship with Blake Fielder Civil.
Oh my soul, I love you!
And the impact it had on her. Here's Sam again.
I wanted to meet Blake, but I didn't meet Blake. I set out to make the film, like I said, through her perspective, so her love of him had to be palpable, had to feel real, and we had to understand why she fell in love with him. And so it wasn't about making a sort of one-dimensional villain. We had to fall in love with him to understand why she wrote one of the greatest albums about their love. And for me, really, the villains of the film, it's addiction and paparazzi.
When you actually look back now at the headlines that were written about her, I mean, I was reading one that said, oh, Amy goes to see Blake in court, but she can't hide the state of her shocking skin. And it's a picture of someone obviously very unwell. Do you think now what Amy went through, what Britney Spears went through, that maybe we've moved on a bit as a society, that people wouldn't be persecuted essentially like that?
I don't know. Recent news may say different. I felt like we maybe had evolved to this place and that wouldn't happen now, but it feels like it is happening.
What do you think she'd make of the film?
I think that she felt like the fact that we've sort of gifted her music back again in a different light, having seen the film. Feedback that we've had is that people want to just go and listen to it immediately afterwards and be more remembered for her music than for her tragedy. Hopefully she'd feel proud of it.
You go back to her.
Charlotte Gallagher reporting. And that's all from us for now. There'll be a new edition of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition and the stories we included, drop us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. This edition was mixed by Callum McLean. The producer was Nikki Verico. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
The Global Jigsaw is the podcast looking at the world through the lens of its media.
State media know which topics they can and can't discuss.
We fill gaps and connect dots to better understand what's happening in the world.
It's important to remember the context.
And untangle the narratives aimed at influencing your views.
Tightly controlled.
It's not so healthy to be a journalist there.
The Global Jigsaw from the BBC World Service. Listen now by searching for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.